Okay, week 8, Social Theory of Law. And now for the final 3 weeks, we're going to be dealing with the issue of rights, human rights, animal rights, and machine rights. Okay, sort of in order of salience, I think, with regard to the legal system at this point. As I can tell from the number of people in the room today, human rights is not what it used to be, as far as an issue is concerned. And I think it's very important to recall, as we live in the sort of death knell of human rights as a concept, to recall what exactly this was all about, okay? First of all, I think I've mentioned this before in the class, is that in terms of something that's internationally binding called human rights, this only really began in 1948 with the UN Declaration. This is not to say that the concept of human rights hadn't been around before. Of course, it had been around for a very long time, especially in the Western philosophical and theological traditions as a kind of ideal. But exactly what it might mean in practice and how it might be enforced, that really didn't come into play until after World War II. And so the context in which the UN Declaration of Human Rights was ratified was very much colored by what needed to be said in the aftermath of what had been the most devastating war in human history, and not only a devastating war, but one where issues of genocide were very much put on the table and mass extermination of populations in a way that really hadn't been seen before in warfare. This is not to say that there hadn't been mass exterminations, but the concentrated effort to do so as part of a general military strategy, World War II was provided a kind of benchmark for that, okay? So whatever one says human rights are according to the UN Declaration, that's going to be very much colored by those specific events. Now, when I was talking to the seminar group that I lead last week, I made some distinctions about what the different legal movements that we've been looking at, the way they would think about human rights. Because so far, I mean, let's put aside the natural law tradition for a moment. Because the natural law tradition is actually the tradition that is kind of used to build up the notion of human rights. Okay, but let's put that to one side for one moment. I'll get back to it soon. But I want to look at the other three that we've been looking at. The legal positivism, and then legal realism, and then last week we looked at critical legal studies. And none of these three movements actually have a role specifically for human rights, okay? In the case of legal positivism, one of the things that's very striking about that kind of way of doing the law, it's a very formal approach to the law, right? So in other words, all of the different categories are defined internally to the law, which means that the relevant legal categories would be categories like person, agency, right? And what their relationship can be, let's say, in terms of setting up contracts, and then rights and duties would be ascribed to the various agents in those contracts. But who exactly counts as an agent, right? This is the point. Now, we may say that we're presupposing that it's human beings who are counting as the agents, but legal positivism is not committed to any substantive notion of the agent, right? And as you know, as a matter of fact, in law, you know, legal agents don't necessarily have to be individual human beings. They could be corporations, for example, right? In certain cases in international law, they could be nation states. Right, so the point here is that legal positivism, because it is defining the categories of the law purely within the law, it doesn't make any substantive assumptions about the kinds of beings that have this status of legal agency and as a result could have rights. It's an open question, right? Now, legal realism, of course, is a much more substantive notion of the law, right, where the law is very directly related to the pursuit of policy goals that are defined, you know, at a political level and are typically seen as politically progressive, right? You're trying to, as it were, get the society to realize certain kinds of ideals that perhaps the society thinks of itself as standing for. Now, in this context, human rights is too broad a substantive category, right? And so legal realism typically would be dealing with the notion of civil rights, right? Where civil rights are the rights you have by virtue of being a member of the society in which the legal system applies, right? So your substantive relationship to the legal regime as a citizen, right, is what brings you in to have the rights that then the legal system enforces. So legal realism operates with the notion of civil rights, okay? And it's an important category. I mean, as we've seen, you know, if you look at the history of the United States and the judicial activism in the United States in the 20th century, right, the idea of making sure that everyone, regardless of race, color, gender, whatever, can enjoy their civil rights is a very important issue on the table. But civil rights is a more restricted notion than human rights. Now, critical legal studies basically thinks that the appeal to human rights in the kind of full-blown way that the UN does reflects basically the way in which the law is alienated from the human condition. Right? In other words, the reason why we need to have a notion of human rights is because the law is normally seen as this kind of constraining force on people's lives, right? That if it, you know, that depending on who has the power relations, can end up making it difficult for people to fully realize their potential. And so then human rights has to be brought in, you might say, as a kind of counterbalance to the way the law works. But for the critical legal studies people, this is to say something negative about the law, right? That the law is in fact too constraining. It does not allow people to exercise their full humanity. In other words, human rights means that somehow humanity has to be added to the law. Critical legal studies, on the other hand, would have it that actually we should start with a fundamental notion of humanity, and that the law should be built out of that. Right? So in other words, if we have a notion of humanity like, let's say, Roberto Unger does, whereby human beings are these kind of infinitely open creatures that are able to change themselves and construct their realities and all this kind of very big romantic vision of what human beings can be, it is on those assumptions then that we should build the law, and the law should be seen, you know, as a kind of vehicle for this kind of empowerment. But that means that you need a very strong substantive notion of the human at the beginning. And I was telling this to the seminar group last week, that if you look at Unger's writings, for example, he spends a lot of time writing about stuff like love and passion and all these things that never enter into the law. But nevertheless, he says, is fundamental to the human condition and is a reflection of humanity's outward-looking nature, right? You know, the fact that humanity wants to connect. You know, that humanity, because the problem is the law, if you think about, you know, the law, let's say, in the standpoint of legal positivism, the law presumes that you have atomic individuals who, through contract arrangements or some other legal formalities, manage to put themselves together into various forms. But Unger wants a situation where, in fact, there aren't those boundaries at the beginning. In other words, we don't start with a notion of humanity where we're already predefined as individuals, but rather we have a much more communal, open notion of what the human is. And then the law gets built on the back of that, okay? So none of these movements, okay, that we've been talking about are actually particularly friendly to the idea of human rights for various reasons, rather different reasons, but they don't particularly talk about it much. Now, I mentioned earlier that in this modern guise that human rights comes out of the natural law tradition. And certainly it's true that when you see the first assertions of human rights, the so-called rights of man, right, the kind of thing that you see in the 18th century Enlightenment, which I signed to you an essay by Hans Joas on Weber, in Weber's discussion of the concept of human rights, that the way in which the notion really gets put on the table in political discourse is through a secularization of the natural law tradition in terms of the rights of man, and these are God-given rights of man, and that's the sort of connection to the natural law tradition, And it is very much connected with the kind of idea that you see in the Declaration, the United States Declaration of Independence, right? That people are entitled to, by virtue of their Creator, entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? These are like the fundamental human rights. And so this connects up with the theological origin of it, and that is, of course, appropriate. But the problem with the notion of human rights in the natural law tradition stated in this form is that it doesn't specify any kind of vehicle for its enforcement. And as a matter of fact, the invocations of human rights that you see during the Enlightenment are all negative. In other words, they are done for the purpose of breaking away from an established order. Right? So the Declaration of Independence is, as it says, a Declaration of Independence. Right? And in the French Revolution, when you get the Declaration of the Rights of Man, right, that is designed to, as it were, start the French nation anew, so that the people who started the French Republic after they got rid of the monarchy, you may recall, one of the first things they did was they invented a new calendar starting at the year zero. Okay? So in other words, they start the world anew. So there is this sense in which the appeal to human rights in the Enlightenment is very much a revolutionary appeal. It is not an appeal that is, you know, that in a way presupposes an agency of its regular enforcement, but rather it is a marking of a rupture away from a previous status quo. Okay? So when Weber is analyzing this as a historical phenomenon, right, the thing that he draws attention to about the notion of human rights in the Enlightenment and the way it functioned in the modern period is that it is a kind of right to revolution in practice. And Weber has a very kind of vivid way of talking about this. He talks about this as the charisma of reason. Okay? Now, I don't know how many of you are learned in Max Weber's works, but the word charisma, which of course we have in English all the time, is his. He's the one who's responsible for this word, okay, Max Weber. And, have any of you run across charisma in any of Weber's writings before? It's a specific term. What does charisma mean in the context of Weber's sociology? What does it generally refer to? What would be a context where he would talk about charisma? Because this stuff that we're talking about here is a little bit off the beaten path from the way in which people would normally encounter the concept of charisma in Weber. So what would be the normal context for encountering charisma?
The charismatic leader.
Okay, what is that? What is a charismatic leader?
One of his ways to explain how people follow, certain religion, or charismatic leaders.
And who would be examples of those for Weber? Who would be an example of a charismatic leader?
Hitler.
What?
Hitler.
Except Hitler wasn't around when Weber wrote this. Someone who Weber would have known.
The Pope? Maybe?
No, I don't think the Pope would count in this context. Maybe the current Pope would, but not normal popes. Yeah.
Napoleon
would count, yes, but in the religious context, who would count? Because the religious context is the original context in which he brings it up.
John Calvin?
Yes, maybe, but Jesus, Muhammad, these are the people he's talking about, right? He's talking about the big guys. Right? And these are the key thing about charisma, right, is it is a mode of legitimation. Right? That is to say that if Weber talks about different ways in which political orders can be legitimated. And of course, the way in which, you know, those of us who are studying the law, right, the way we normally think about legitimation is kind of like the way the legal positivists think about it, right? In other words, you know, one law or one adjudication is justified in terms of following from the other laws. Now, for Weber, that is what he calls legal, rational, or bureaucratic, right? Because there's a sense in which the legitimation is happening within the law itself. the legal machinery, as it were, right? But charisma is the opposite of this, right? Charisma is where the legitimacy comes from the person. It's very, you know, if, you know, legal positivism is a very impersonal way of legitimating the law, right? Well, charisma is the opposite, is a very personal way. And so the idea here is that when people follow someone because of their charisma, right, there's a sense in which the reason why words like cult and sect apply, right? You know, you are following the person because you believe in the person. And that's why whenever the charismatic leader dies, there's always an issue. Jesus dies, Muhammad dies, what are these guys, what does this happen? You know, if you look at all those great religions, Buddha, right, all these guys, right, they die eventually, and then the problems start. Because what counts as legitimation once the charismatic leader is gone? Because a lot of people are going to start competing amongst themselves, right, to take over. And it's in that context that you then get, as it were, different traditions of interpreting what the charisma was. You know, what is it about Jesus' message that really mattered? And then you get different views. You know, it's in this context, Weber argues, that you then get something that looks more like normal legal traditions. Because the different interpretations of what the charismatic leader did or said become the basis for these different strands of legal interpretation, which compete against each other and may or may not be integrated together into some kind of whole. Okay? So this is kind of the way... So Weber focuses initially on religion, largely because religion, you might say, has been... The social institution through which the law in the pre-modern era has generally developed. Right before nation states, how would the law have developed? It would have developed through the legal traditions, primarily through the different interpretations of whatever is regarded as the sacred word, which then gets you back to the charismatic leader. Okay? Now, this is, I think, pretty understandable, and I may have mentioned before, earlier in the course, maybe hermeneutics. You've run across, hermeneutics is this art of interpretation, right? When one wants to talk about how do you make sense of the law, should you understand the law in terms of what the original founders of the law thought, or should you understand it in terms of how it applies to today, right? There are different ways of interpreting the law. And in a sense, these traditions that we've been talking about in the course reflect that. And this general business of trying to interpret the law is called hermeneutics. And this arises once you start to codify what you take to have been the charismatic thing that everybody was following in the beginning. Right, so... historically, you know, the first lawgiver is Moses, right? Moses, you know, in the way which people like to tell the story, right? Moses gets the Ten Commandments from God. You can't get any more direct than that, right? And that sort of begins this whole chain. And then people are listening to Moses, and he's got the Ten Commandments, and then Moses dies, and then there's an issue of who takes over. And then that issue continues. And of course, then you get all of the various schisms within Judaism and Christianity, and you get then... you know, Islam after that, and that's kind of how it goes. Now, when Weber is talking about human rights, he talks about the charisma of reason, which is an interesting concept, okay? And this has a lot to do with a certain conception of the human being that is very much tied with the idea of human rights. Because remember, the notion of human rights, because you might think, here's one thing to think about. When we think about human rights, there are lots of different levels at which to address the matter. And in fact, one person who I recommend, and I'll be making reference to him next week again, is Wesley Hofeld. Have you heard of this man, Wesley Hofeld? Wesley Hofeld was a professor at Yale Law School in the early 20th century. Okay, so he's actually a contemporary of the legal realists, but he was of a much more, he's a kind of a, a guy who in a way is like halfway between legal positivism and legal realism in his sensibility. And what he did was he was the first person to really come up with a very analytic conception of right, the idea of right in the law. And it's basically a fourfold notion. He's got four categories. And the key thing that is important here is that Hofeld starts from a conception of right at the kind of basic level, you might say, which is connected to what? The integrity of the body, the interest in survival, right? That kind of notion of right, right? A kind of self-protective right, right? A right to continue to exist, right? When we talk about the idea of the dignity of the human body, you know, the right not to be tortured or maimed or harmed, you know, that kind of sense of right. Right, it's basically a self-protective notion of right, and that is the kind of right that we may see, you know, animal rights people, for example, invoking that conception of rights. Kind of the concept of right degree zero, as it were, right? The basic notion of right, the right to exist, basically. But then you go up the scale, okay, and at the top of the scale is this kind of right to self-expression. Right? In other words, not the right just to be protected, but the right to extend yourself, right? The right to do stuff, the right to go beyond your own boundaries, right? So this is very important. So if you think about the various rights that have been, you know, in the forefront of modern law, we talk about the right of self-expression, right? The right to speak your mind without imprisonment. That's one right. The right to work. The right to work, namely the fact that you can actually go out there and offer your services for employment. Right? You're allowed to do that. I can turn you down, but I cannot stop you from trying. Okay? So these kinds of rights that kind of get the individual out of their body, in a sense, get them out there, extending their powers. Right, this is the kind of higher level of right, and it's the notion of right that is associated with autonomy. Right, autonomy being this very important value of self-determination. Right, I am the master of my fate. I can do stuff. Right, and you know, one of the most important ones, of course, is the ability to enter into contracts. Right, whereby you say, I'll do something, and you'll do something for me, and we're bound together, and we are entering into an arrangement that previously didn't exist, which will give me something I previously didn't have. So the rights are very, you know, so the idea of the right is a very elastic notion. And so Hofeld, you know, lays all this out, and I think the thing that's very interesting from the standpoint of the history of human right as a concept in terms of the charisma of reason, is that the charisma of reason enters at the top stage, right? It is basically about the idea of human beings asserting their rights to self-expression, right? That's the kind of right we're talking about. The sort of right that would lead you to engage in a political revolution is not a right of self-protection. It is a right of self-assertion. Right? This is the important thing. And so what Weber wants to argue, because Weber has very mixed views about the concept of human rights. Here I think, again, let's point out something just so we get the history straight. As I was pointing out before, Weber lives before Hitler. Weber dies in 1920. Okay? He dies just after World War I is over. This stuff that he's writing about is in the beginning of the 20th century. So keep that in mind. Think about what would be the sorts of historical events that would be informing what he's thinking about. American Revolution, French Revolution, and of course, the most recent revolution, the Russian Revolution, 1917. All of these revolutions have this idea of rights involved. And what this rights talk does, especially understood in this sense of autonomy, is it empowers people to destroy their government, start anew, commit violence. And this is what Weber means by the charisma of reason. Because by people coming to a certain kind of self-conception of who they are, that actually gives them the confidence to go out there and to do stuff that they wouldn't do otherwise. Right? Because the very people who end up committing these revolutions are the people whose parents were very obedient to the status quo. Right? So why the change? Why the change? You see? I mean, the interesting thing, because, see, if you go back to the Middle Ages, when I think I pointed out when we were discussing natural law originally, there was a right to revolution, but the right to revolution was in the name of restoring the natural order. So in other words, if you get rid of one king, you get another king in return, and the king restores the order. That was the idea. But here, we are talking about a much more radical sense of revolution, one where you get rid of monarchy altogether and you put in its place a self-governing people, a democracy. And so Weber is very struck by this, namely the way in which people have to think about themselves in light of believing that they have these human rights that then empower them to overturn centuries of authority. Okay? Weber's view on this, and I think Weber is just trying to talk about this at a psychological level, Weber says this is fanaticism. Right? This is fanaticism. And I think he doesn't mean this, I mean, I don't think he's being particularly positive about it, but I think what he's talking about in the first instance is the psychological state of people when they're doing this. Right? They have to be, in some sense, intoxicated with the idea that they are self-governing, self-legislating beings. Right? They have to get into a new mindset. And you see, this is the key thing, I think, if you go back to the way in which charisma was originally understood in the religious context. The people who were the followers of Jesus or Muhammad or Buddha, these people, the original followers, they were also themselves seen as being in a kind of spell, right? As being kind of captivated by a certain kind of understanding of themselves and the world that was brought about. And this then led them to think they could do all kinds of things, right? You know, including, you know, in the case, some cases, perform miracles even, right? But it gave them a certain kind of power. Right? And it was a power that enabled them to suffer the consequences of violence. You see? And this is kind of what Weber is getting at here. Namely, that human rights, as a concept, when it is internalized, has this enormous power. So Weber, I would say, never would have imagined that we would have something like the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which in a sense makes human, normalizes human rights as part of international legislation. You know, with courts administering it and stuff like that, the way in which, and of course, Europe is the same way, right? Europe has kind of a version of this. I don't think Weber ever thought that human rights would be domesticated in this way. I think he regarded human rights as having this kind of almost manic quality when people believed it. Okay? Because the thing here is that, you know, What makes the Declaration of Human Rights something that actually has binding legal force is that there are courts that administer it. Such things didn't exist before, okay? And in fact, the first time that the world tried to have a court after the League of Nations in World War I, that totally failed. Right? Yeah.
When putting human rights into the law, can you say in some ways it's preventing revolution because it's like amalgamating it in so they don't get the revolutionary ideas to overthrow. So the idea is pulling it in so they have the ability of staying status quo by having more leeway.
You mean the way we do it now?
Yeah.
Yes, that's the point. Yes, exactly. That's right. What has happened as a result of having these courts of human rights and the Declaration of Human Rights and, as it were, writing human rights into the law is it domesticates it. It makes it something manageable. It makes it something you can administer. It makes it something where you can say, you're violating human rights, or you're upholding human rights. You can make those kinds of legal judgments. Whereas when Weber is talking about human rights, he's talking about a period before that was really on the table. He's talking about the way in which human rights had been invoked politically, which was primarily in the context of violent revolution. Okay, so the point is there's a big difference. You know, this is where the history matters. Because it's only after World War I, because of the devastation caused there, that you actually get world leaders beginning to think that you actually need an international court of justice, right? And to administer something called human rights that would be legally binding cross-nationally. And the League of Nations tried to institute this, but it failed, World War II happened, and then it got put back on the table with the establishment of the UN, and of course, that has had a bit more durability, especially, you know, with war crimes and things like this. And Europe has this too. But my point is, this domestication of human rights, which is, I think, the way we think about it today, right, where human rights acts as a kind of natural law principle over civil law, is a creation of the post-World War II period. That before World War II, human rights was seen in a much more mixed fashion because it could legitimate revolution in the violent sense. Okay, so this is the thing. I mean, it's in the context of people talking about the rights of man and all of these kinds of things that you actually start to get this notion that the people are the law. Right? The people are a law unto themselves. You may have heard these kinds of expressions. These kinds of expressions actually arise in a human rights discourse that is trying to separate itself out from ordinary civil law. And that's where the potential for violence comes in. Okay? And this is what Weber is responding to. And this is why when you read Weber's, you read the article that talks about Weber's views on human rights, you will be struck, I think, by just how problematic Weber finds human rights. Weber does not really think it's a legitimate legal idea at the end of the day. When he thinks it is an expression of fanaticism. Okay? If you were to ask Weber, okay, Weber, how do you enforce what we would normally call human rights here? He would go for civil rights, right? In other words, by treating nation states as absolute sovereign, right, they are the ones who have the responsibility for delegating rights to its citizens and maintaining them. So in this respect, you know, Weber would be somewhere like in this legal realist tradition, maybe, or maybe legal positivism, depending on what you're thinking about, yeah.
But the power of sovereign would be able to restore it, take away those civil rights.
What?
If the sovereign had the power to bestow, would it be able to take the civil rights away as well?
That's right, the point is that there are no rights if you're not a citizen.
Okay.
Right, that's the point. That the rights come from the state. Right? Weber is a person who believes that when we're talking about politics, we're talking about the monopolization of power, and in the modern era, that is in the sovereignty of the state. So in this respect, Weber is a kind of sociological version of Hobbes. And so whatever rights you have, it is delegated and maintained by the state. And that's why civil rights are the rights to have. Because they are the rights that the state delegates to you and will enforce on your behalf. And if you're not a citizen, then you have no rights. I mean, you may have, as it were, allowances, right? The people may let you move around and do stuff, but you don't have proper systematic rights because you're not formally recognized. Right? And so if you think about the cases in which human rights gets invoked nowadays as international legislation codified, you know, one of the places where it's most helpful is precisely in the cases where people are stateless. Right? If you're stateless, right, and you don't have a sovereign looking after you, giving you your rights, where do you get your rights from? Right? And this is where human rights becomes very important. Okay? But Weber does not have this conception. Weber's conception is, if you're not a citizen, you don't have rights. And this is why things get very interesting when you start looking at, you know, you get into Germany, actually this is true throughout the early modern period. If you follow what gets called the Jewish question in modern Europe, in the 19th and 20th centuries, okay? The Jewish question, it turns on the issue of whether Jews can be citizens. Okay? And then the question is, okay, if they're not citizens, what are they? Okay? And there is no, as it were, court of human rights, as it were, you can appeal to. So you really do need to depend on what the state's disposition is to the individuals living in it. So this is quite a kind of profound point in a way, and it's one of the reasons, you know, given the nature of both World War I and World War II, both of which involved enormous displacements of people, and, you know, in the case of World War II, genocide, all the rest of it, that you know, this is where the notion of human rights as something that has to be written into the law becomes important. Because civil law by itself is not sufficient to capture everything that you need to capture about human beings. Too many people are basically left unrepresented in the law, right? And this is where, and in a way, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. You know, legal positivism may seem like a kind of strange, abstract way of thinking about the law, but in fact, it's kind of a normal way of thinking about the law, because the law typically does not have any a priori commitments to the entities covered under it. I mean, we assume it's about human beings, but it doesn't follow it's about all human beings, even if it is about human beings. Right? There has to be some way of converting you into a legal agent, a legally recognized agent. There's a process, and that is called citizenship. Now, you may be born into citizenship, which makes it easy, but if you're not born into citizenship, you have to acquire that status. How do you do that? That has not historically not been straightforward. And if you don't acquire it, then you have no status. You're not legally recognized. You're outside the system. And if you're outside the system has no responsibility for you. This is a very important point. And when you start looking at the way in which Nazi jurisprudence starts to fiddle around with this notion, you can begin to see how you can end up in a situation where the Jews are basically non-recognized. They don't, you know, you don't have to worry about what you do to them because they're not legally recognized. It's like they're not there. They're just stuff. They're just matter. Okay? And here, if you're interested in Nazi jurisprudence, right, you know, Carl Schmitt is your man, okay? He was a very important legal theorist and actually a friend of Max Weber. I mean, Schmitt lived into the 1960s, but he was a friend of Max Weber, younger friend. They both together wrote bits of the Weimar Constitution, the first democratic constitution in Germany, which had that notorious state of emergency clause which Hitler invoked when he got elected, right, which then completely turned the whole thing upside down. And Schmitt was a very consistent defender of Nazi moves as being constitutional, right? I mean, this is the thing about that one of the things that made the Nuremberg trials so interesting and also so difficult was the fact that it was very difficult to say that the existing constitution of Germany was in fact violated by anything that Hitler did. Okay? So you had, you know, so whatever grounds you were going to use to prosecute those Nazi judges, you know, and officials who were carrying out the orders, it was very difficult to actually invoke German law against them. You'd have to invoke something else against them. And again, this is another context in which the Declaration of Human Rights gets invented. Right? Because within very well codified civil law constitution, it is possible to actually externalize people you don't want so they have no standing and you can do whatever you want to them. Okay? This came out of the Nuremberg trials, and this is, you know, Nuremberg trials is 1946, UN declaration is 1948. Okay? So this is very much, you know, in the thinking here. I think nowadays, since we live, 60, 65 years or more since the UN Declaration, we kind of take for granted that there are human rights and that they can be enforced, you know, and that the law somehow is based on them. But this is just something that only happened after World War II, and to this day is still, to a large extent, being made up as it goes along. Okay? Because as we know, not all countries enforce human rights equally. And as we know, even from the standpoint of the European Court of Justice, vis-a-vis the constituent members of the European Union, including this glorious country, right, that there can be human rights violations going on here too. And they're just taken for granted, especially with regard to work laws and some criminal laws, right? So this is something that is very much a work in progress. Now, when you go back to 1948 and you look at, okay, whose idea was it to actually have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the name that gets put on the table is the philosopher Jacques Maritain, French philosopher, who is a follower of Thomas Aquinas. Right, Thomas Aquinas being the great natural law theorist of the Middle Ages. Jacques Maritain is this kind of what they call Catholic modernist. Right, in other words, someone who wants to reinvent the natural law tradition, but within a broadly secular context. And so he is the one who actually develops a lot of the wording that is put in the Declaration of Human Rights. Now, the one thing, now when we talk about the Declaration of Human Rights being based on natural law theory, we have got to be careful about what we say here, because natural law theory lacks a very important, in its traditional form, in the form that Thomas Aquinas would have recognized, natural law theory does not have a very crucial ingredient that human rights, the Declaration of Human Rights has. And that is, natural law theory does not recognize the fundamental equality of all human beings. It recognizes that all human beings have the right to protection, the right to live, the right to a livelihood. They have a right to flourish. All of this is very much part of natural law tradition. In this respect, it is very much a pro-human kind of understanding of the law, right? Where we want human beings to live and flourish. But there is nothing in natural law theory in its medieval formulation that says all people are created equal. They are not created equal. They are created according to what their role is in the world. Right? So there is an assumption, you might say, in the classic natural law theory of somebody like Thomas Aquinas, of there being something like a natural hierarchy. Right? Remember, natural law theory was originally the legal system applied to feudalism. Lords, serfs, that kind of thing. Right? That was what natural, and when we talk about the maintenance of the natural order, we are talking about the masters being masters and the serfs being serfs. In other words, everybody where they belong. And everybody being respected for the job that they're doing where they belong. So in other words, the fact that I am a serf does not mean I am not entitled to respect. But I am entitled to respect only as a serf. I am not entitled to respect as some kind of wannabe master. Okay? So there's an idea of a natural order, right, which is a hierarchical order, which is very much built into classic natural law theory. Now, the idea that human beings are equal, okay, is one that, of course, you find in the revolutionary statements of human rights that I was talking about earlier. But in terms of a kind of codified sense of equality, a kind of equality that's enforceable, that is historically associated with citizenship. In other words, when we make you a citizen, we make you an equal of everyone else who is legally recognized. Right? You become another voter, just like all the other voters, for example. You become entitled to all the services, just like everybody else who's a citizen's entitled to. Right? That kind of equality, the legally recognized equality, historically has been associated with citizenship, and citizenship is something, as I said, provided by the state. It is not provided by God, it is not provided by nature, it is provided by the state. And so your formal equality is relative to being a member of a state. And that's what civil rights is all about. Civil rights is about that level of formal legal recognition. So what human rights does is to bring together natural law theory and this kind of civil rights theory. Because civil rights are relative to states. But here we're talking about a sense of legal equality that transcends national borders. In other words, you don't need to be a member of a state in order to be recognized as an equal. So under what legal regime is that possible? Under the regime of human rights. So human rights has a very special status, right? And so the human rights say all human beings are not only entitled by nature to live and to flourish and all that, but they are entitled to be treated as equals. Okay? And that is the introduction of a civil rights mentality into the natural law tradition. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting, if you look at the history of civil rights, starting with, ancient Athens or Rome, Republican Rome, and you move into the modern era of the city-states and all this kind of stuff, is that historically, civil rights have always been seen as precious things. In other words, relatively few people living in a society would actually have civil rights, would actually be citizens. You think about Athens, right? 10% of the population of Athens were citizens. Similar situation with regard to, what are you doing here?
Oh, sorry.
No, we're having a class, get out. okay, so in ancient Athens, in Rome, 10% of the population is citizens, right? And how did you become a citizen? Well, again, you are either born that way, you're one of the, so in the case of Athens and Rome, you were part of one of the founding families of the city, right? I mean, so there was the kind of clan basis for the city. That was very much part of it. Or you could buy your way into citizenship, right? In other words, you could show that you had some skill or some trade or something that would actually increase the general wealth of the society. And so people from the outside who weren't born in the city could buy themselves into citizenship. But you see, that's a pretty high bar, isn't it? That's a pretty high bar. And so what you end up getting in the history of civil rights is that until you get modern nation states that are quite large and find it to their own advantage to actually have a lot of people as citizens, civil rights tend to be very, small pockets, as it were. Okay? Little cities, that are embedded in great empires where basically a natural law theory applies where people are unequally treated. Okay? So human rights here brings the two traditions together. A kind of natural law tradition, which previously had been very hierarchical, and a civil rights tradition, which previously had been very elite, and puts them all together into this one international, cross-national notion of all human beings being covered equally. Okay? Now, the question is whether these two ideas sit together very well. Right? I mean, I think this is kind of the issue that we'll be discussing in the next couple of weeks. Namely, is it possible, can you actually enforce? Because as you know, human rights is the kind of thing that is enforced when based on a adversarial basis. Namely, somebody actually has to bring a case up, right, that is alleged to violate human rights, and then something gets sorted out. But is it possible to actually have a regime, a cross-national regime, that literally would be in the business of protecting human rights on a regular, ongoing basis, and not just wait for these kinds of cases to arise that are usually very extreme? Okay, so and that is a very ongoing, discussion within the legal field, namely whether at the end of the day human rights can be legally enforceable in the way in which other parts of the law are enforceable. Okay, I'm going to stop here because we're getting very close to the end. And so next time we're going to continue along this line and move into the animal rights, because now we've got animals muscling in for some of the action, and we'll see where we go from there. Okay?